I know. You're wondering, where the hell have you been, Ian? It's been over a month. Yes, March 25th was the last time that we got together for Don't Read the Comments. And the only thing I can say in my defense is I've been crazy busy. Busier than normal, if you can believe it. In addition to, you know, parent stuff and a day job that's completely blown up. I've also been getting ready for the Chicago Critics Film Festival, which is coming up just in under 2 weeks. So actually you can check out, shameless plug, information on that in the description below. But it's going to be at the historic and wonderful and awesome Music Box Theater starting on Friday, May 13th. Don't let the date fool you. It's going to be good luck for the festival this year. It's the ninth year that we've been doing the festival. With a slight interruption from COVID a couple years back, of course, like with everything else. But beyond that, you're not here to watch me shill for film festivals, no matter how amazing they might be. You're here to watch me read comments. And yes, we've gotten a deluge of feedback at the website in the last month. So strap in. I hope you've got some coffee or some wine or whatever you prefer to drink while you're eating. While you're eating? While you're watching these things. Or if you want to eat something and grab a snack, go ahead and do that. So for those of you who aren't familiar, this is the Kicking the Seat comments section writ large, writ live. So, well, or recorded to video. I don't know. I'm tired. It's been a long month. So essentially, any feedback, any comments that we get on kickseat.com, on the Kicking the Seat YouTube channel, on, well, not Twitter, because that would just be insane, but basically the Kicking the Seat Facebook fan page, any place where you can reach out to me with feedback, I take that feedback, I read it, I react to it for your enjoyment and, dare I say, education. So without further ado, I hope you're ready, because this is going to be a good one. We actually got, as happens a lot, we got a comment the very day I sat down to record this this message, so this morning, and it's going to be the final comment for this edition, and boy, is a good one. So here we go. First up, Bobby Lawson wrote in with a comment on the career opportunities episode I did with Eric Childress a while ago. Bobby says, "You guys made some great points on this movie. Thanks for posting your thoughts. If it were me doing the story, I would have ditched the thieves altogether and instead focused on the romance angle between Jim and Josie. That said, though, the main female character in Career Opportunities, Josie, has an unrealistic premise, which is that a trophy princess has the ability to be kind, have the ability for deep thought, be willing to foot the bill for a trip, go for a dude pushing a broom at a discount store. It has also been said, however, that art gives us something we cannot have in real life, like a Josie McClellan, a goddess with the heart of an angel, which is someone only to be found in a movie like this or another dimension of existence. This is why films like this will always have a place in the hetero man's psyche." And I can appreciate the fact that a good part of the story takes place in a Target store. As of 2021, there are still Target stores throughout the Midwest USA, despite the presence of Walmart. Heck, every time I walk into a Target, I can't help but think of Career Opportunities, LOL. Final thought. Though Career Opportunities was filmed in the latter part of 1990 and released in 1991, the story and screenplay had to have been written sometime in the 1980s, which in my humble opinion, aka IMHO, made the final production have an 80s gestalt. One might argue then that this movie was the very last of the campy 1980s films, marking an end of an era that many yearn for. I cite the fact that it was filmed in an actual shopping mall, in the Anchor store, a Target store that uses the Target name in the movie, with growing nostalgia due to the dying off of these malls in today's current dead mall trend. My apologies for the longest post. I subbed to your channel, and thanks again. Well, Bobby, I appreciate the feedback. Thank you. I would kind of push back a little bit. I know some very attractive, or have known some very attractive goddess-like people. They've been very lovely and have found, you know, wonderful partners. I don't know that any of those partners were pushing brooms at Target, but, you know, who knows? Maybe they had at some point. So, yeah, just because a person is hot or attractive or has god or goddess status does not mean that they cannot also be very kind people. That feels like a meme or an idea or a trope that comes from, dare I say, the movies. You know, I also can't speak to your real life experiences. So I apologize if you went through, you know, some hardships in that regard. But I like the idea of what you said of ditching the thieves storyline, although I do think it adds a nice little catalyst for Jim Dodge and Josie McClellan, you know, getting out of Dodge, as it were, with the kind of, I guess, the necessary heroism to step up and kind of prove themselves I do think it would have been more interesting to have more of a relationship-focused film, much like the other John Hughes movie, Some Kind of Wonderful. I think there's a kind of a dynamic that could have been explored there. But I also am nostalgic for the 1980s and 90s mall culture, strangely enough, even though I didn't go to the mall that much. It was always just kind of nice to know that they were there. I felt the same way about like Borders Bookstore. I went to Borders a lot, but especially now that they're gone, whenever I pass an old mall that has what used to be a Borders in it, I get a little bit weepy inside. And I also, too, cannot go to Target without thinking of career opportunities. In fact, I was in one this morning and just imagined skating around in a tutu and a wife beater to Where Are You, Baby? But that's neither here nor there. Next up, we have a comment from Fletch on our Hammerland Dracula Prince of Darkness episode saying, Hammer Films subscribed. Awesome. Welcome aboard. Thank you. I, too, am a big fan of Hammer Films. And also on the Son of Hammerland episode, The Mummy, Fletch says, my fave growing up. Indeed, one of the joys of watching these films, and this will kind of come back around in that last comment I teased earlier, is discovering movies that I had kind of written off or was even barely aware of as a child, discovering them as an adult and kind of feeling like a kid again. So yeah, just because you missed it the first time around doesn't mean that you can never capture that magic. But it's also pretty great to have those movies that you grew up loving and watching and sort of informing your film tastes throughout your life. So very cool. And thank you again. Next, we have Dang Budang commenting on my interview with The Devil You Know writer-director Charles Murray, saying, this guy is very inspirational. I just learned of him from his Breakfast Club interview. Great filmmaker. I actually got to go look up that Breakfast Club interview because I only got a few minutes with Charles, but The Devil You Know was a very impressive movie. I'm pretty sure it's on VOD by now, but you should definitely check it out. But he was just an amazing conversation. And the little bit of time we had together, we talked about his relationship with Jeff Loeb of, you know, DC and Marvel fame. We talked about Charles's experience working on some of those big comic book TV show properties and also stepping out to direct his own very personal independent films. So yeah, he is an inspirational guy and, you know, makes an impression in just a little bit of time. So definitely check out that interview if you haven't watched it yet and go support his work because, yeah, he's a hell of a guy. Next, we have a comment from Petty, our MVP commenter slash live stream fan, writing in on the Morbius live stream we did back at the beginning of April. See, I told you it's been way too long since we've gotten together. The live was excellent and your colleagues are great. Although it sounds repetitive, I always want to comment on how good they are and I can only write praise. This last minute of the live is unmissable. They made me cry with laughter. Yes, that was a hell of a way to end the show and I'll leave that up to you all to go and watch that live stream and cry with laughter, as Petty said. But yes, Petty, I enjoy, in fact, I speak for all of Earth's Mightiest Critics when I say that we enjoy you chiming in the comments section, always asking really kind of fun questions that are springboards for a good conversation. So thank you very much. Here we go. From Kool-Aid Man OG, writing in on the West Side Story episode I did with Armand White. We did not care for the movie, unlike a lot of folks who seem to really be head over heels for Steven Spielberg's 2020 run remake. He says, sounds like you and Armand need a safe space. Top five Spielberg easily, certainly his best since Artificial Intelligence. Top five Spielberg. I don't doubt that you are sincere or that you weren't 3 weeks ago when you wrote this, Kool-Aid Man OG. But I think this feels to me like a new movie comes out from a great director. It's instantly evaluated and a lot of people instantly place it in the top five. But you've got a hell of a deep filmography with Steven Spielberg. And I can think of 10 Spielberg films that I would put above his West Side Story remake, possibly 15, possibly 25. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. As they say in France, chacun a son goût, which means everybody has their own taste. As far as Armand and I needing a safe space, it is no secret that we got into sort of an anti-progressivism rant there in our West Side Story coverage. But I would say that the need of a safe space would only apply if we steered away from talking about things that are sort of, you know, edgy or challenging. We went right for it. So I also find it ironic that I'm being lectured to by someone named Kool-Aid Man. Sounds like there's been some Kool-Aid drinking on the other side of this comment. But, you know, whatever. Thank you. Next up, we have another comment regarding Mr. Armand White. This is from the Make Criticism Great Again conversation, which was one of our earliest conversations. It was a hell of a chat. It actually inspired the ongoing kind of series that we do, where we've talked a lot about Steven Spielberg movies, but also about silent films, and he's a font of knowledge. I'll just say this about Armand White. If you only know him from his reputation of being a troll critic, you really need to read his film criticism, not just, you know, stuff about like kind of social media capsule reviews of, you know, comments and things like that. He's a deep thinker. He's a brilliant analyst of film. And in his book, Make Spielberg Great Again, and also The Press Gang, which is a collection of his writing along with people like Matt Zollerseitz, you really get a feel for his depth and breadth of writing, and just the lyricism of his words. But speaking of Armand's words, Armand needs to turn on the lights in his room and put a ring light behind his camera. That's not so much to do with his words, but that's the visual component of the problem. The other is I've gotten some feedback about Armand's audio in the past. So yes, I'm quote unquote working on that. I'm going to propose some ideas to make the visual and the audio quality a little bit better in our future conversations. So hopefully that won't be an issue, because I would hate for the aesthetics to kind of get in the way of the ideas. Okay, now we have a comment from Jenny Rocher. This kind of takes Pat McDonald, the Uber critic, and I to task for our review of Summer of 42. This is a good one. Quite a bit of misinformation here that literally minutes of research could have corrected. The often oddly snarky tone of this markedly unprofessional commentary makes it clear that there's no point in trying to speak to every error because there are simply too many. So I'll just mention a handful here. Most glaringly, Hermann Rauscher is not dead. The title is Summer of 42, not The Summer of 42. Both the novel and the screenplay were written to honor Ossie, who was killed in action in World War II on the author's birthday. Great points. Honestly, the title, I mean, that's a little bit, I'm sorry if we referred to it as The Summer of 42 instead of Summer of 42. I mean, we may have mentioned that in the conversation, but the title is right there up in the thumbnail. So what are you going to do? What struck me is that Jenny Rocher has the same last name as Hermann Rocher. So I'm assuming there's some kind of a relationship there. And I do appreciate you speaking up for the author, who Pat nor I don't think we realized that the author was still alive. A lot of these conversations we do, there's not a whole lot of research. Now, some may find that a fault, and I totally understand, respect that. But a lot of times when I get together with friends or even fellow colleagues and critics, we watch the movie, we talk about it, we bring what we know and appreciate the films to the fore. Sometimes we'll be able to bring up some facts and information, but a lot of it is off the cuff. We're not, you know, holding up monocles and you know, sipping cocktails and smoking cigars and having an official, like, snobby film forum. It's conversations between friends about movies that we love. And I should point out that we both love Summer of 42. Yeah, we're snarky and possibly markedly unprofessional, a phrase I definitely appreciate. But, you know, geez, we did like the film. So sorry if we got a lot wrong. You know, that's the fun of, you know, not quite live podcasting. But what are you going to do except try and be better or something? Another comment regarding a podcast I did with Armand White. Jeez. But yeah, this goes back to West Side Story from Timothy McFerrin. 2824 is 100% spot on. That's a timestamp. I went back and I looked it up, and it was a moment in the conversation we were talking about the opening shot of West Side Story, which opens up on some kind of like almost like gray, you know, misty rubble in New York. And Armand and I kind of picked up on the idea that, or I think Armand might have pointed this out to me. I don't even remember if I realized it, that there's some real like bizarre 9/11 style imagery to that shot. But it turns out, of course, that that's not the rubble of, you know, the Twin Towers. That's the construction or the demolition of, you know, the old neighborhood to put up the kind of the new construction in West Side Story, which kind of kicks off a lot of the class struggle in that film. Yeah, it's a very bizarre choice. Armand considers it to be a deliberate choice and sort of problematic. So apparently, Timothy McFerrin, you agree, and I can't say they disagree. Getting deeper into that would probably involve or necessitate me watching West Side Story again, which I will never do, unless we're talking about the original, which is a masterpiece. Next, we have Horror 101 with Dr. AC, talking about the indie scene interview that Sajio Akinayaka and I did with Henry Fool star Thomas J. Ryan a few weeks ago. What an incredible film, and how the heck is it 25 years old already? This is starting to get a little alarming in that the movies I actually saw in the cinema are turning 50 this year. What a great catch to land TJR for this interview. Such a charming individual with so many great stories. Amazing that this was his first film. Well done all. Yes, I totally echo AC's points on this one. Thomas was an amazing guest, an amazing get. Sajua actually reached out to owner Tukel, who directed Thomas in one of my favorite movies of last year called Scenes from an Empty Church, and helped arrange this this interview. And at some point when I get some free time, I'm going to actually try and coordinate another interview with all four of us to talk about Scenes from an Empty Church and other things. But yeah, I'm glad you liked the interview. For folks who have not seen Henry Fool, it is a wonderful Hal Hartley independent film from 1997. Yes, 25 years old. Can't recommend it highly enough. And Thomas J. Ryan, especially if you watch Scenes from an Empty Church and then you watch Henry Fool, two completely like opposite ends of the spectrum characters, but both masterful performances. So yeah, definitely check it out. Next, we have Petty again, commenting on the review I did of La Dolce Vita with Pat the Uber critic McDonald. The conversation with Pat was very, very interesting and captivating regarding the exchange of ideas between the two interlocutors. An Italian movie that is one of the greatest exponents of nostalgia is Nuovo Cinema Paradiso. Hopefully the analysis of it is planned in the future of the channel. Your wish is our command. And actually, Pat wrote back to say, wow, thanks for watching. Ian does such an excellent job. Thank you. But Pat, I got to say, we were being called out. We were called out a few minutes ago for being, you know, totally inaccurate and you know, snarky and all that stuff. So I don't know if that qualifies as excellence, but I appreciate your enthusiasm. I should also mention something that I hadn't realized until I was looking at that that comment from earlier. Herman Raucher wrote Summer of 42 and another film that Pat and I talked about that we loved. He wrote the novel for Watermelon Man, which is a Melvin Van Peebles blaxploitation film from the 70s, which is, you know, it's another terrific movie, one that I loved. So you can go back and watch us review that and keep an eye out for the snark and the misinformation. The Monitor 72, chiming in on the Devil You Know interview I did with Charles Murray, also said, I loved the movie, as did I. Done. Go check it out. The Devil You Know. Horror 101 with Dr. AC chimes in again, this time on an episode of Son of Hammerland that we actually recorded together for The Scream of Fear, saying, I apologize, Oliver Reed is not in Nightmare from 1964, but he is in Paranoiac, 1963. We're just getting it wrong left and right on this channel, gang. I'm totally sorry. Also, spoilers. This goes for all of you who are watching this. I went back and revisited the ending due to our confusion over whether she got out of the car, and it's perfectly understandable that we were confused. We see a shot from the inside of the car going over the cliff, presumably from Penny's point of view, which would seem to indicate that she was in the car when it was going over. However, later she says to Jane that she jumped out of the car, so there you go. There you have it. I hope that's not too spoilerific, but yes, definitely check out Scream of Fear. It sort of came out in the wake of Psycho and is sort of lumped in with the Psycho imitators, but it's not. It's its own thing, and you know, some terrific performances, some really crazy twists, perhaps even maybe one too many towards the end, but definitely recommend that one. Nope, Sorry, I forgot. There's more to this comment. Also, the police inspector is, in fact, on site to witness Robert's last act with the wheelchair. Please come with me, Monsieur Robert. Which is strange, because when Jane's solicitor is leaving, he tells Robert that there is no one there except the girl in the wheelchair. I guess the solicitor didn't notice the inspector or Dr. Gerard, which is again understandable since they both suddenly magically appear standing there when they weren't there a second ago. As you were. So, yes, for those of you who have not seen Scream of Fear, this will make no sense to you, and I hope you forget it by the time you watch it, because it is really spoilerific. For those of you who have seen Scream of Fear, take that as you will. Mrs. Chester chimes in on the Academia Giallo episode we did on the New York Ripper to say Brian is the best. And I agree, Brian Martinez is the best, and he can catch his stuff on the Giallo Room podcast, which is linked down below in the comments. You can also find him pretty much every month on Academia Giallo talking about Giallo films. Speaking of Sergio Aconiaca, he actually wrote in to comment, a very lengthy comment, a very detailed and specific comment, on my written review of The Secret Society for Slow Romance, which you can rent right now. He's actively working on the sequel, sequels, I should say. But yeah, I wrote a lengthy review of Slow Romance on kickseat.com, which you can go check out. The link will be below. And Sergio wrote in. Now, again, I really liked the movie. I'm getting more flack, I think, for movies that I like than movies that I hate, which is a very strange position to be in. But, you know, it's a comment, so let's go through it. Thanks for reviewing the movie, Ian. Here are some thoughts, re some items raised in the review. I look forward to hearing about this in your next Don't Read the Comments video. Well, hey, here we are. First, thanks a lot for appreciating the cinematography in the movie. Making a movie look good and beautiful takes a lot of work. I imagine it does. Yes, the movie is not a typical romantic comedy. It does, however, capture real-world elements of some relationships. Re-theatricality in acting. Some real-world people, specifically in New York City, are very theatrical. Renee is a more low-key character, while Allison has some theatrical moments. I agree, and I think I pointed out this out in the film, there is a difference between realistic acting and theatrical acting. And if you're going to present a realistic character as being theatrical, there should be some element of realism or naturalism mixed in with the theatricality, or comment on that theatricality from a character who is not acting theatrical, if that makes any sense at all. Essentially, if I'm sitting down with someone and they're acting all kind of big and broad strokes, and this is a real world situation, I'm going to say, what's with the affect? Bring it down a little bit. What's going on? You don't sound like a real person. But that's just me. The solution to world poverty presented in the movie is not naive. It's one of these solutions that has worked in the real world, increasing productivity, giving people more work, providing funding where needed. Over the past 100 years, that approach has significantly reduced world poverty, and prior to the pandemic, the UN estimated that we are about 10 years away from the worst levels of poverty being eliminated on Earth. Now, it may take a bit longer due to problems being caused by the pandemic, war, etc. Yeah, I agree. I've heard that same statistic about poverty being reduced, and it has actually gone down globally, in the last number of years with several initiatives. However, as presented in the movie, there is, let me just say, I think I need more details on this, because without giving too much away to your film for people who haven't seen it, it was almost as if, like, hey, we should end poverty. Here's a bunch of money, cut to poverty ending. You know, it sounds great, but it's also sort of the equivalent of saying, man, I really need to buy that mansion. Hey, look, here's $1 million. Problem solved. Anyhow, compared to My Dinner with Andre, Slow Romance is very similar, except romance is primarily a positive and realistic story, as realistic as Andre, and is one that works well in the feature-length film format. Not for everyone, obviously, but many who have seen the movie have enjoyed it. A lot of people are used to the three-act structure from Hollywood movies. Slow Romance tells the story in a different way, multiple scenes leading up to a conclusion of the story in the final scene, similar to the structure used in Werewolf Ninja Philosopher. There I would disagree, because you could just about take many of the conversational scenes in Slow Romance, and again, I'm trying not to give anything away, mix them up, play them in a different order, and it would not affect the outcome of the story, necessarily. Werewolf Ninja Philosopher is also told in these sort of like vignette style structure. It's not a traditional three-act narrative necessarily, but it is told in an order that if you swap those things around, for the most part, you'd lose sight of the story. I made a comment in the review that slow romance oftentimes plays like a series of webisodes that are kind of strung together, and I stand by that. Using cell phones to make a movie is reality in the 2020s. There is a shot of Allison working on one of her movies, a black and white shot towards the end of the film, her movie. Many things from their days together are not shown. It's only a 95 minutes long movie. There are, however, plans to make movies about filmmaking where we see films being made. Yeah, and yeah, I understand that. However, the Allison character, because the movie is about two filmmakers in New York going on a series of dates and getting to know each other. The Allison character, I don't think I have these statistics lined up, but she's made something like 20 feature films and 150 short films. She's not that old a person, which means from my point of view, and I understand you can make movies fast and, you know, especially with the advent of technology, but I don't think that 150 short films and 20 features being made at such a young-ish age lends itself to things like going on dates, constantly posting on Instagram, not making movies. Now, it could be that because we have cell phones, I could literally film myself recording this video, slap some titles on it, and release it as a short film. I don't doubt it. But Allison's goal is to make it as a big shot kind of independent film person. I don't think you get there with that kind of movie. You know, again, maybe I'm being naive, but it just rang a little bit strange. There is more of a story in Slow Romance compared to Andre. I found Andre to be an interesting slice of life and counter movie, but romance is more enjoyable. More happens over a long period of time. It does take place over a long period of time, but as far as what we get to know about these characters and their inner lives and stuff, I got to give that to Andre. Tension, arguments, conflicts are devices used in movies, not necessarily things people experience in the real world on a regular basis. I don't know what reality or what people you're hanging out with, Sujiwa, but I got to majorly push back on this one. Renee uses his happiness skills in the movie to keep conflicts from arising. That's an aspect of that character and the movie, a non-conflicts movie for a comedy that can work. I disagree. Comedy is all about conflict and contrast. On top of that, Renee uses happiness skills in the movie to keep conflicts from arising. That raises some kind of weird questions about agency, say. Ultimately, it is a matter of taste. Movies work well for some and not so well for others. All in all, I'm glad you watched the movie twice and wrote about it. Slow Romance 2 is coming soon. And I look forward to Slow Romance 2 and actually Slow Romance 3. There's going to be more characters. I'm a big fan of Sujiwa's movies. We do a monthly show together talking about independent film. And it's always delightful. But when it comes to this particular film, and I've watched a number of his movies, this one, you know, I liked it, but it left me with a lot of questions, which is not necessarily the best place to be at the end of a film, at least not the kind of questions that I had. And you can read more about that on the review. And also you can check out the movie and all of Sujiwa's work at the links below. Wet Dog writes in with a comment from our Academia Giallo trauma live stream, which we did last week. Another great podcast. My personal problem with trauma is that the kills are all the same and don't leave you wanting the next one. Probably Savini's worst work. I suspect that the decapomatic idea stems from the garrote idea in the novel of Phantom of the Opera, which is one of Argento's favorite books. Interesting. I agree. This is, you know, I'm a big fan of Tom Savini's, makeup effects going all the way back to like Dawn of the Dead and Friday the 13th. But this, you know, just didn't quite cut it for me. We have a comment from Kathy Fisher. Great interview in regard to my interview with Neil Fisher, who wrote Being Patrick Swayze, a wonderful book that came out last week that I highly recommend. I highly recommend the interview so you can get to find out why this isn't just a meme book, but actually a very profound and funny exploration of what made Patrick Swayze such a great performer, actor, activist, conservationist, just from many accounts, all around great guy. And from a huge Swayze super fan like Neil Fisher, it's a great conversation. And I see that this is Kathy Fisher writing in, I presume also a relation of Neil's. So yes, you should be very, very proud of what Neil has done and will continue to do in the future. He's also one of my favorite independent creators. You know, he's done plays and movies, direct a lot of commercials, but hell of a dude. Next, The Doomer writes in. with a comment on the last Wednesday Night Live live stream that we did recently. Possible end credits for Moon Knight Episode 6 idea. Scene: Oakland, California, high-rise apartment, ancestral plane. Scene: Hippo goddess Tarwet nervously knocks on apartment door. Door opens. Eric Killmonger stands before us with a slight smile. End scene. They already touched on Black Panther in the series. That makes the most sense, and we all know Killmonger is coming back eventually. That would be great. I was really disappointed. Although I did like the end of Black Panther, I thought that letting Killmonger go was a big mistake. Kind of like killing off the Joker at the end of Tim Burton's Batman. You know, nice and a big grand finale, but you know, you want to see the Joker back, and I want to see Killmonger back. Another comment from Horror 101 with Dr. AC. I think you're the MVP of this installment. Oh, wow. Perfect timing. I did a 14-film Verhoeven Film Festival last year, so they're all fresh in my mind. Haven't listened to the episode yet, but excited to see this pop up today. Yes, Mike Crowley of You'll Probably Agree and I did a review, a double header of RoboCop and Basic Instinct because they both have anniversaries this year. It might seem like an odd pairing, but not as odd as you might think. There's some congruity there, and go check out the episode and see for yourself. And yeah, thanks for AC for checking it out. 14 Verhoeven films. I wonder if Basic Instinct was in there, because we got to talk about that one. Wow. Last but certainly not least, we have DS commenting on the Cavalry Trilogy video that I did some time ago, talking about three films of John Wayne and John Ford. Now, this is the one that came in just this morning, so yeah, made it right under the wire. And at first, I thought that this was my wife trolling me and that DS has the same initials as my spouse, but she doesn't watch this content, so that would be impossible. DS says, not knowing John Wayne is a huge blind spot for a critic. I run into this kind of thing a lot. It's a very interesting take, and I understand the position, but I don't agree with it because I am a film critic. I assume DS is not. There is no master list of, you know, the 100, the AFI's 100, top 100 films that a person has to have watched and acknowledged and written about and commented on before they get their official critic's card. Now, ideally, a film critic worth their salt will have seen all the great movies and commented on them and thought deeply about them and can spread this knowledge and interweave opinions about, you know, films between genres and decades and all of this stuff. But that's the rare breed. A lot of film critics, they get into it for the love of film. They figure out how to express themselves. They find an audience and they develop a relationship with that audience. Some people revel in snark, and misinformation, such as I do apparently based on the earlier comment. And some are more, kind of astute and scholarly in their presentation. I kind of envy those people because they have the time and the resources to weave together this tapestry. I'm just kind of flying by the seat of my pants a lot of these cases. So I understand where you're coming from. I had watched, I think, one John Wayne film in high school, and that was The Searchers, a movie that I loved, another John Ford Western. But I didn't follow up and watch the entire, John Wayne filmography after that point. I, came back to him decades later. And that's okay, because the beauty of being a film critic or just being someone who's passionate about movies, regardless of whether or not you express your feelings about it, is that you've got time. You know, I'm catching up on Hammer films, movies I barely even knew about or, kind of dismissed all my life growing up. I'm finding out about them as an adult. Same with the Giallo films and, slow cinema and all of that stuff. You come to movies when you come to them. And hopefully you have enough time, enough wherewithal to dive into the greats. But I don't agree that not knowing about John Wayne is a big blind spot for a critic, unless your bread and butter is, Westerns or other genres that he was, war films, other genres he was, keyed into, or key to, I should say. I like Westerns. I like war films, but this isn't a Westerns and war films podcast. If it were, then you're darn right I'd bone up on my John Wayne. As it stands, I watch his films when the occasion comes to me. I try and do that with a lot of filmmakers, a lot of genres, a lot of, performers, a lot of just movies, classic films. The list of movies that I have not seen that I quote unquote should have seen by now is as long as my arm. And I'm making it a point when the opportunities present themselves to check those out, to talk about them with friends, to be educated about them. I'm not going to go spouting off about, you know, something that I'm seeing for the first time. Wait, actually, that's not true. Forget what I just said, because as the Summer of 42 commenter mentioned earlier, I guess I kind of do that all the time. But then again, these are not, you know, monocles and top hats film reviews here. These are people getting together to talk about movies that they love or movies that they hate in a fashion that sort of resembles like the coffee shop conversations I used to have in high school around the time I was watching The Searchers. You know, you get together, you watch a film. If you come to a brand new movie, chances are you haven't spent days or weeks or months researching every bit of nuance about it. You come to it as you come to it. And you can learn about things later that might change your opinion on it. And, you know, maybe you reevaluate. And even if you're a critic, maybe you come back and you do a follow-up review or a follow-up piece of commentary to say, hey, I was wrong about this, or look what I learned. Yeah, I'm rambling. I'm on a soapbox of some kind. So I'm just going to step off here and say, yeah, it might be a blind spot for a critic, but certainly not this critic, because I do my best. I would like to watch more John Wayne, and I will in the future, guaranteed. But that doesn't discount the knowledge that I do have in other areas or my bona fides in general as a film critic, at least not in my opinion. And I am in no way biased in that regard. So, yeah, if you made it through that entire thing, your trophy is in the mail. That's not true. That's more misinformation that I like to spread here on the Kicking the Seat YouTube channel, apparently. But yeah, thank you for sticking around for Don't Read the Comments, whether you stayed for all the comments or some or just the ones that you happen to write in for. I appreciate the feedback. And yeah, if you'd like to see me read your comment here in the air and reply to it with sincerity and maybe a little bit of snark mixed in, please just leave a comment on any of the Kicking the Seat venues. That's kickseat.com, the Kicking the Seat Facebook fan page, the Kicking the Seat YouTube channel. Hell, leave a comment on this video and I'll react to it in the next Don't Read the Comments. Hopefully that'll be more frequent than a month from now, but who knows? As I mentioned, there's a lot going on. There's a Chicago Critics Film Festival. There's live streams out the wazoo. There's other movies to watch and read about. I'm going on a business trip in a couple of weeks, which is going to take up a lot of time. So yeah, I'll get to them when I get to them. We'll be back at some point. So until next time, whenever that is, whatever that is, thanks very much for watching the Kicking the Seat YouTube channel. If you like this content, be sure and like and subscribe and tell your friends and all that good stuff. I'm done shilling, and I'll catch you next time.